Do you know someone who has done something outstanding in the field of human capital management? Nominate them for Federal News Radio's second annual Causey Awards. Together, we'll call attention to what may be a best practice in government. Anyone can be nominated, career, political, and contractors working in the HR field. The award is named after Mike Causey and his lifelong dedication to the reporting of management and federal pay and benefits issues. To nominate someone for the Causey Awards, go to federalnewsradio.com, search award.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
Michael Caine is the Chico for Energy, talking about recommendations for a new performance management system.
Director Barry is very direct. He expects us to get him a fairly detailed set of options and a project plan. We're going to break it down into a number of working groups that are going to work in parallel. So we're going to practice what we preach here. It's all about inclusion. It's all about getting diverse viewpoints.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Well, what else would we do on March 28th other than talk about taxes? So as we all bring our tax returns down for a slow landing, if we have not filed, or if you have filed, maybe this will provide some pointers, as well as planning for 2011. And John Elliott, federal benefits strategist?
Yes.
Retired Fed?
Retired Fed.
And he's going to ask me a lot of questions about taxes this
seminar
this
speaker.
Yes,
I forgot benefits about on the federal benefits,
yes,
aspect of our seminars.
An email responder.
That too. And I'm here about, on an average, twice a month.
Yeah. Co-hosting the show. And my name is Bob Lines. I'm an accountant type, and what else would I talk about other than taxes? So, here we are, March 28th, 2011, 10:07 Eastern Time, and we'll be on for another 50 minutes. So, if you'd like to call, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. And certainly we'll take tax questions, but benefit questions as well, Social Security questions as well.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's start off with, if you will, tax theory. People that I work with, what can I tax deduct? And let's take a look at what a tax deduction is. If you spend a dollar for a tax deduction, you get tax savings, but you don't get a dollar back. You get some percentage based on your income tax bracket. I'll leave that one go for a little bit, but let's say somebody's in a 25% federal tax bracket and a 5% state bracket if there is a state return. So 5 plus 25 is 30. So for every dollar they spend, they save 30 cents. For every $100 they spend, they save $30. For every $1,000 they spend, they save 300. Now that's good, but it needs to be clearly understood that when you spend that dollar, you're not getting a dollar back unless it's something called a credit. We'll leave the credits go for a little bit, but when you talk about tax deductions, it's really based on that. So what tax deductions are available to somebody now for their 2010 return? And it would be pretty much a stretch to say that there's a lot. For example, the one that jumps to mind would be a traditional IRA if you could tax deduct it. And if you make that investment in the traditional IRA by April 18th, although I would urge people to do it by the 15th, although I think the 15th falls on a Saturday, so it'd be the 14th. I just don't want to be in line with everybody else on the last day and not get the money in.
Right. Now, when you talk about deducting a traditional IRA, it's my understanding, of course you will quickly correct me if this is wrong, is that somebody who has a defined benefit plan, as any federal employee or retiree does, by definition, my IRA stopped being tax deductible during the last tax reform effort in 1986. Am I correct on that?
You're absolutely correct.
So what happened? But then a year later, the TSP started, which I was happy about, because then I could fully deduct the amount of my TSP contributions to reduce my taxable income, because up to that point, we had IRAs where up to the reform of 86, we could deduct our contribution amounts.
This is true, and you hit on step two of the first step. If one could deduct an IRA, it would be a tax deduction. But as you indicated, many people can't, not solely because of their coverage under their defined benefit plan for CSRS, whatever, but also 401k plan, also known as a thrift. So if an individual had a thrift savings only, but not a defined benefit, now it's a rare person in the federal government, but there are some. Or outside the federal government, if somebody happens to be married or somebody's listening that isn't a Fed and they're covered under a 401k, that's considered to be a plan that would prevent them from deducting their traditional IRA if their income exceeds a certain level. Now, this is where eyes start to glaze. The entire return starting in 1986, really its focus is something called adjusted gross income, which is total income before your different itemized deductions. And it basically said there are certain provisions in the law that you would be entitled to enjoy if your income was below a certain level, and what they're talking about is the adjusted gross income. For example, a single person could still deduct a traditional IRA and be covered under FERS and covered under the thrift if their total income was under $56,000. If that person or persons were married, that number would be $90,000. So you could still have a deductible IRA for somebody maybe earlier on in their career, maybe mid-career even, and still be covered under their, like you say, defined benefit, FERS or CSRS, as well as the thrift. And the thrift actually reduces one's income for this test. Now, I'm not saying people should deduct their traditional IRAs. The issue that we're talking about is what's left between now and April 18th, April 15th, as far as deductions go. And there's very few things, because the majority of everybody, the vast majority of everybody as an individual taxpayer, pays taxes based on a calendar year cash basis. In other words, you have to do something within the calendar year in order for it to be deductible or for it to be income. In this case, we're looking for deductions, and that's about it.
I heard on TV this morning that 30% people itemized and 70%, therefore, I guess, take the standard deductions. So the point this, I don't know if it was the senator was on, but one of the people on the program, Morning Joe, mm-hmm. give him a plug, was making the point, well, if only 30% itemize, the rest of the 70% are kind of subsidizing the 30% who have enough deductible items where it pays to itemize, which I thought was an interesting point. And I think I sort of had a hint of that before. But, you know, he made it very clear, at least that was his viewpoint, that about the many, many unfair aspects of our tax system.
Well, let's take a look at that, because it really hits two segments of one's work life, if you will. Early on, when one first starts to work, chances are they don't have a mortgage, and they get something called a standard deduction. What is a standard deduction? The IRS says, here, we'll set the bar at a certain amount, and if you can itemize your deductions and get greater than that, they'll allow you then to itemize. If you can't, they'll give you this flat amount. Now, for a single person, that flat amount is $5,700. For a joint situation, it's $11,400. And then they have other filing statuses called head of household, which is somewhere in between at $8,400. So what it really says is the standard deduction will just give you. You don't have to tear your hair out trying to figure out whether you can find an extra deduction or not. This is what we'll give you. Now, if you want to spend the time and look for charitable donations, look for state and local income tax paid or withheld, look for medical, and I hope they don't qualify for medical, because medical has to exceed, again, a high percent of one's income. So the only way you're going to get any benefit out of the itemized deductions is to beat the standard. And I won't say 100% of the time, but much more often than not, it's because you have a mortgage and real estate taxes on the house, because mortgage interest, for the most part, is deductible, and real estate taxes would always be deductible. So you're what you got out of that is 100% right. There are people on two ends of the spectrum. The early on, they don't have the mortgage. The later on, they've paid the mortgage off. Not everybody, but more so than not. So they're kind of scratching. And I sit down with the younger folks and I say, you don't need to scratch. You're never going to get there. So let's just take the standard. I'll try to present a discussion that will make sure that you haven't overlooked anything so that we could itemize. But more often than not, we're spending a lot of time with no result. And then in the latter part, sometimes the people that are used to itemizing, all of a sudden say, I can't itemize anymore. I say, well, that's a good thing, because now you get a standard that's better than what your itemized would be.
All right. Well, I'll use myself as an example, because that's all I know about taxes is what I do or with our income. But my bank, our bank, was very eager to sell us a home equity loan. Okay. And it was a very low interest rate. That's neither here nor there. But anyway, it was attractive, so we did it. So the interest on that loan is deductible. What do we use that for? We haven't used it for anything but to buy a couple cars, two or three cars. I mean, it's serial fashion. And then they even upped the amount of our loan limit, because we were, I guess, paying it off at a rapid rate, as we did. But I get a tax-deductible car loan. Now, not everybody can qualify, much less have their bank call them, do you want this loan? But I get a tax deduction on my car purchase loan that most people don't get. Some people just don't realize that this is available. Or they may not qualify. Many people out there may not even qualify for such a loan. Now, the risk is, of course, if you default on that loan, they can take your house. It's like foreclose on your house. But if, you know, you're way above water and you have plenty of equity because you've had the house, which is our situation, because I'm older.
So am I.
Yeah, we are older. And you know, it can work out pretty well, and it did work out pretty well.
But do you want to know why you can deduct the home equity line even though you used it for something personal?
Okay.
Here it is. Let's say you go to the dealer, and the dealer has a very good rate, and I'm not talking against dealers. And you'd say, okay, I'll do that. Sounds like a good interest rate. And then you're listening to the show, of course, and the subject of equity line comes up. Now, you can't deduct the car loan from the dealer because the car is the security for the loan. But what you can deduct the interest for the same purchase of the same car, if you used it with an equity line, because the security for the equity line is not the car. It is your house.
Right.
And so Congress said, listen, if somebody buys a house, we'll allow them to deduct mortgage interest up to an extraordinarily high number, $1 million, plus another $100,000 if they have an equity line. So if somebody didn't have a mortgage but had a house and did have an equity line, they could use the equity line and use the interest. It's perfectly legitimate. That shouldn't be looked at as anything else other than an opportunity to deduct something that you otherwise couldn't if you had financed it through the dealer. So that's the reason why it's secured by the house. Now, that equity line can be used for anything.
Sure.
Cars, furniture,
home
trips.
Home improvements.
Home improvements are even better because you can even borrow more on an equity line if it's used for home improvements.
Yeah, it's something worth considering. But the point is that's just another feature of the tax law that favors, I will say, more affluent folks than non-affluent folks, you know. And you could probably come up with many more examples. That's just an example I personally encountered. And I'm, you know, we don't have to get into, you know, the the vagaries of the tax code unless you want to.
No, we don't want to.
But
we want to keep everybody awake.
Yeah, but there is that aspect of it, and further, you know, it's kind of what this Senator Durbin or one of the panelists on this show.
You bring up again something that somebody could miss. Because it's not a home mortgage. Now, you do get a form, and it kind of doesn't tell you you can deduct it. But if you got a form, at least you would scratch your head to see that you could deduct it. But let's just say you do a return manually. Heavens forbid, but let's just say that you do, because they're very hard to do anymore because there's this interrelationship with income. It's 2% of this, 7% of that. But if your income exceeds this, you can't do that. And so it's much better to do it with a computer program. But let's say you're doing it manually. So this would be something that potentially could be overlooked. There's another thing that if an individual works, they have something called a make-work-pay credit. And you'd say, well, wait a minute, you just introduced now another word. You talked about deductions, and now you're talking about credits. Now, here's the difference. If you have a credit of a dollar, you get a dollar given back to you. You have your taxes reduced by a dollar, or in this case, a dollar given back to you, simply because you worked. And if you're single, that's $400. If it's joint and both work, it's $800. It's a credit.
Right.
And now you might not pick that up if you're doing your return manually, but I'm certain that you would be prompted with a computer program. I'm not here to sell TurboTax. I'm not here to serve accounting services to sell them. I don't want to do that. I'm just saying the return is so hard anymore, unless it's just, you know, very basic. We just got out of school. We went to work. We have a salary. We have a few dollars of interest. And I don't know that you need a computer program to do that.
Yeah, I used to do it manually back in the day. And then we went to TurboTax, and ultimately I went to a professional. And my experience with TurboTax was pretty good, except there were some years where I was using TurboTax, where I was, as I still am, was self-employed. So I had to pay the employer share of the FICA tax in addition to the employee share. So that seems to me should include TurboTax, and maybe they've corrected this because I've had used a CPA, a live person, warm body for the last 2 or 3 years. But it didn't, until I actually went to a professional, I didn't know what a simplified employer plan was. Well, Bob can explain what that is, but the bottom line for me was by contributing to this SEP, and I could contribute roughly a quarter of my income each year, I dramatically reduced my taxes, and I wasn't spending the money anyway. I mean, that portion of it anyway, I could, you know. But my point is that the TurboTax, and forgive me, TurboTax, if you're listening, you may have corrected this, but when they realized I must be self-employed, they should have asked the question, it seems to me, have you considered a simplified employer plan? And then you click, and then information, what is that? And then information comes down on the screen and explains it. And if I'm still confused, then I ask you. But the upshot was, it was a good thing for me to do. And I only knew about that by actually talking to a tax professional.
So let's follow up on that. What John's talking about is if somebody has self-employed income, and let's say that that same person also has a job. Let's say it's a federal job, and they're covered under FERS, they're covered under CSRS, they're covered under the thrift, and they do some moonlighting, and they make X dollars. They still can put money into what John's talking about, this SEP. It stands for self-employed plan, and it's like a super-duper 401k, so they can have a deduction on top of a deduction. Now, in John's case, if I'm not mistaken, you had recently retired from the feds and you were doing self-employed activities at one point.
Yeah, my self-employment started about 3 years after I retired.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I was employed by a private firm.
So the point being is John could have that, and so could the listeners if they have self-employed earnings, whether it's theirs or if they happen to be married. Everybody isn't married, but if there's a spouse. So That, I find, actually is one of the more popular things after the end of the year, because you can fund an SEP
up
by
to
April
15th.
If you go on extension, you can file it up to October 15th. So it's something that you can do after the fact. And again, there's very few of these things. So those are pretty nice. And there are certain different strains of SEPs, some jazzier than others. But if you want the jazzier one, you have to set it up before the end of the year. But nonetheless, it, again, it gets back, and you were right on target. Well, what can I do after the end of the year? Well, after the end of the year, those are kind of, I won't say easy pickings, because they're not. But let's say that somebody sits down and says, what deductions am I entitled to other than the obvious? Well, let's take real estate, for example. Real estate taxes on one's home, of course it's going to be tax deductible. But some people miss. They might have a small lot somewhere where they bought years ago. Well, the real estate taxes on that lot, or two lots, or three lots, they're deductible as well. Then you get into the area called state and local income tax. All states don't have a state and local income tax. Locally, we do, but the listening audience isn't only comprised of Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., so outside of the Beltway, if you will. If you don't have a state income tax, or if it's very low, you can account for your sales taxes paid during the year, and if you find your sales taxes are greater than your state and local income tax, you can itemize them and better yourself. And again, you're not spending any more money than what you already did. Mortgage insurance premiums, maybe earlier on in life, you might have them. Later on in life, you don't, because the mortgage is being paid down. Charity. Now, you generally know whether you gave something away or not after you've reviewed your check. What do you call it? Check book, but that's really dating myself. So if you're doing it on Quicken or QuickBooks, and you can pull down, and hopefully you've coded it into the charities. But what about non-cash? People come in with vivid imaginations of what that stuff is worth. And they're fine, folks. There's nothing wrong. They just say, you know, this is really nice. You know, it's worth X. And I said, well, if it's worth X, why did you give it away? And so the rough yardstick, and I'm not a wise guy with it, but then they go, I guess you're right. So if you were to take 20%, I mean, this is really not for all things, but if you were to take 20% of the purchase price, you're probably bordering on going too high, but still safe. Or if you did give something away because you felt very emotionally charged with the organization that it was going to, and it was worth more than that, then if it's worth an awful lot, you might have to have it appraised. But here's the other catch. The IRS allowed charitable donations for years and took people at their word, but some people abused it. So they now have a provision in the law that if you donate, you're supposed to get an acknowledgement back from the recipient organization if it's a check or if it's cash. If it's non-cash, you can give up to $500 away per your evaluation, and there's really no record keeping required other than your personal record keeping. There's no IRS record keeping. But if it goes over $500, you have to fill out a form. Now, it's not an audit me form. It's just rather organized form. It says, okay, you gave away. Who'd you give it to? What's their address? Not that they're going to check on you. And what did you give? And when did you give it? And where did you come up with the value? Now, it's not as exhausting as I'm making it sound, but some people think that's per item. That's a summary of all the things that you would have given away during the year if it exceeds $500 in total, whether you gave it away to one organization or 10 organizations. You still have to fill out this form. It's not a particularly hard form to do.
Yeah, you see a lot of people donating their cars to charity, as I recently did. I recently donated a vehicle to charity that I was sick of. And the way it works is they then auction the car, and then that establishes, then they give you back the receipt, of whatever they call it, showing you how much they got for the sale of the car. And I haven't gotten mine yet. I donated in 2011, so it'll be next year we'll take it off. But the amount you deduct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That is recent. Prior to that, I had one client, and fortunately she's still a client. And she was buying cars at auctions for $175 and donating them and claiming $1,000. And I said, can't do that. She got very mad at me, but found out that you know, was accurate. It's the fair market value of the car. Now, what better test of fair market value? And IRS was good with this. And they said, listen, if you donate an automobile to a charity, we're going to give you the deduction. But if they take that car and then they sell it, that's going to be the determining value, and they will send a form right to the IRS and, of course, to you. Now, on the other hand, if they use that car in the betterment of their organization, in other words, they use the car to drive people around or pick things up, then you can deduct the, quote, blue book.
Right. Oh, I see.
See, that's the difference.
Yeah. No, my understanding, my car was going to be auctioned
off. Right, and as is
although
most.
I haven't heard, it's been almost 2 months since I gave it up, but I haven't heard that they've been able to auction.
Do you want to? I'll give you a horror story.
Uh-oh.
And this happened. It wasn't with a car. These folks, very kind folks, and they inherited a home. It wasn't of significant value, but it wasn't of insignificant value. And they had it appraised. They did everything right. And they claimed the appraised value on the tax return because the property, they gave it late and it wasn't sold, and it was in every indication that it wasn't going to be sold. Well, then later it was sold. And the charity just happened to sell it to a cozy relationship, and it was sold for far under the market value. And it goes into the IRS. The IRS contacts these people who are extremely honest, and they say, you claimed way too much on the value of your home. And I got into it, and I found out I couldn't do names because I'm not going to get sued, but I mentioned to them, here are the comparable sales in the neighborhood. Why did this one sell for so much less? Could there be a cozy relationship? And the IRS, a lot of people badmouth them, and I've been doing this an awful long time, and I've found them not to be bad folks. They're reasonable, and the person was reasonable. I said, listen, why don't we meet midway? I think I can smell something here, but neither one of us are going to be able to prove it. Would your client agree with that? And I said, I would think so, but they should have the final word, and they were very happy to do it because it made them very nervous that they were being audited for something, given this house to a charitable organization to be used within the organization, but they sold it. Anyway, that was a rough story. But the auditor was reasonable, and I'm sure it wasn't a rogue auditor. Their supervisor said, yeah, this makes sense. All right, let's look at another thing that people can still deduct even as we speak, because we did it in the prior year. There's an area called miscellaneous itemized deductions. Now, why is it different than the other ones? Well, all the other ones are very pre-described. Medical, well, there's no question what's in there. Taxes, there's no question what's in there. Interest, there's no question what's in there. And charities, there's no question what's in there. But there's a slender thread of logic that runs through every page of the IRS code, and it basically says if you earn money or you make money and you expend money to do so, they'll allow you something called a miscellaneous itemized deduction. For example, let's say that anybody listening, anybody in the studio, anybody in the building that takes a course to become more proficient in their profession, it would be, generally speaking, a miscellaneous itemized deduction. Let's say somebody buys TurboTax. That doesn't have a thing to do with their job, but it has everything to do with saving money. Or they use a tax preparer. Or they use a financial planner, and they pay a fee. Why is it deductible as a miscellaneous deduction? Because they made more money, hopefully, with the financial planner. And people say, that's great. I missed that. That's terrific. I can deduct all that. Well, no, you can't. It's like medical. The sum of all your miscellaneous itemized deductions, whether it's TurboTax, whether it's the financial planner, whether it's the accountant, tax preparer, CPA, whether it's books that we bought, the sum of all that has to exceed 2% of our income. Well, that's pretty hard to do. So depending on in the stage of your career, but again, the early stage of one's career, the standard deduction is going to be greater, and the latter part of one's career, we probably don't have as much of that. Maybe the tax prep part. So the miscellaneous deductions then, for those of you who are saying, well, gee, I didn't think about that, do it, but remember, it's got to exceed this 2%, and that generally knocks people out. But people like to hear, can I deduct this? And I go, yes. And they don't hear the but. And I said, but it has to exceed 2%. He said, you told me I could deduct this. And I said, yeah, but, oh, yeah, you did say that, didn't you? So, again, these are kind of last-inning moves. And I might even say that's about it. And probably the best time to do any tax planning is not now for last year. It's now for 2011. There isn't much you can do now, as you can see. We walk through the greater areas. There's a lot. There are other really sophisticated things, but let's leave really sophisticated things alone. But between now and the end of the year, we have the opportunity to do things that we can't do after the end of the year because we're calendar year cash basis taxpayers. So I don't think anybody should go out and buy a house just to get an interest deduction. You buy a house because you need a house, and you don't buy a bigger house just to get a bigger mortgage deduction. Then you don't buy a bigger house just to get a bigger real estate deduction because you still have to pay it. And remember at the top of the show we talked about if you do have an itemized deduction and you spend a dollar, you don't save a dollar. It's based on one's tax bracket. So tax planning, you know, we beat the thrift drum as much as anybody when we do this show. So if we haven't maxed the thrift, or we can just notch it up a little bit, and certainly to get to the matching part. That's not only tax planning, that's financial planning. So, I mean, it's a double, maybe a triple win there. Save taxes, enjoy a greater benefit when the money comes out because it's been able to grow without being taxed over the years. And if we've maxed out on the thrift, which is not the easiest thing to do, but if we have maxed out on it, then we can always put money into a Roth or a traditional. I'm going to eat my words there. You can't always put money into a Roth. You can always see if you can put money into a Roth. There's certain income restrictions like anything else, and these are pretty high. So if your income exceeds $179,000 and you're married, you're not getting any money into a Roth for that particular year. Now, you can still put it in the traditional, but not the Roth. If you're single, it's $122,000. Now, again, that's a high number. That's kind of where you fall off the edge of the cliff. But prior to coming to the edge of the cliff, you might be able to put a partial amount in. It's kind of got like a phase out. So an individual married filing joint, if their income was below $169,000, they could put the full amount into.
But I heard in 2010, these income limits for the first time went away where anybody could be in a Roth. So what am I missing?
You're not missing anything other than it's another subject.
Oh.
You're absolutely right. Let me finish with this and then ask me the question again.
Because I am kind of confused.
Okay.
Though.
Let's put it this way. What John is talking about is coming in the side door. What I'm talking about is coming in the front door. All right. So if I want a Roth IRA and I don't want to be concerned about income, then my income has to be below 169 if I'm married, below 107, and I can put money directly right into the front door of the Roth. If my income is somewhere between 169 and 79 and 107 and 122, it starts to phase out so that once my income exceeds that level, I can't do a Roth. But here's what John was talking about. Let's say you can't do a Roth because you're lucky enough for your income to be that high. You can still do a traditional IRA. There is no income ceiling on a traditional IRA. The only requirement is that we have earned income. Earned income is four things. Salary, wage, small business profit, alimony income. That's it. Notice I didn't say annuity income. So salary, wage, small business profit, alimony income. And we can put money into a traditional IRA. We can't put it into a Roth because, fortunately, our income is higher than that. But once it's in the traditional, you can certainly transfer it over to a Roth. Now, how soon you can do it is a subject for another day, but let's just say it's sooner rather than later. And this is exactly what John was talking about. Prior to January 1st, 2010, there was a roadblock, and it said if your income, I don't care how you file your return, if your income exceeds $100,000, you cannot transfer money from a traditional IRA to a Roth. You cannot transfer money from a thrift to a Roth. I'm not saying you should. And so people couldn't do it. Well, they opened up the gates in 2010. And people moved the money over. I'm a little surprised. It's a smaller percentage than I thought it would be. A lot of discussion about it, but not a lot of movement.
But when you move from a traditional IRA to a Roth, aren't you obligated to pay taxes due on that traditional IRA that has heretofore been tax-deferred?
You are a good man, John Elliott. All right, so John brought up then the second leg of this. Yes, you can do it, but anything in taxes, yes, you can do it, but inside of a traditional IRA, we might have two different types of income. We might have income that was earned once the money was put in there, or we might have income that was put in there that we did not get a tax deduction for. All right. Now, if we put money into an IRA, let's just make it real simple. Let's say it's the only IRA we ever had, and we put in $5,000 or $6,000, depending on our age, and we had earned income, but we were fortunate enough to have income over a certain level. So we couldn't deduct the money going into the traditional IRA. So they call this, quote, basis. And you're supposed to fill out a form that could not be less complex. It's going on 8606, and you should always fill it out. It's got three lines on it that apply to this. It's very simple. Anyway, so on our form, we tell the IRS, listen, we put in $5,000 or $6,000 this year, and don't think you're going to tax that because this is my basis in it. I didn't get a tax deduction for it, so I sure shouldn't have to take it taxes when I take it out. Now, we're not going to take it out. We're going to move it over to a Roth. And we move that money over to the Roth, the first $6,000 or $5,000, depending upon age, that we move over to the Roth. We don't pay taxes on.
Right, because you've already paid taxes.
Right, but yeah, if it earned anything, we will.
Of course.
But, of course, we get a little escape valve with the TSP if we find that the TSP earnings power is greater than what the Roth would be. We can move the earnings from the IRA into the TSP and basically strip out the earnings and just move over the non-taxable portion. Now, I went out on the limb a little bit with that, but it is accurate.
Right.
But that's why you have to fill out this form 8606. And I find, of course, we do it at work, but we get new clients and maybe they hadn't done it or somebody else hadn't done it in the past. And so it's pretty simple to fix. You just file it with the IRS and they might charge you $50 a year. But at least you're on record that this is what I did and this supports what's on the tax return. So, John, you're right. There was that income restriction to move money from a traditional to a Roth. The other income restriction that I was spending a lot of time on was the beginning was to really get it into one type of IRA versus another.
Yeah, and those listeners who under CSRS or CSRS offset who have a voluntary contributions account, you can move that directly to a Roth.
Yeah, you can, and you can strip the earnings out and move it into the TSP.
So. Right, the interest portion, yeah, you'd move to the TSP, which is very easy to do. TSP 60, and then the principal or balance, the non-interest or the non-earnings portion, you can move into a Roth. And I do get questions on that.
Okay,
now, fairly frequently.
We need to be aware of two things that came out in 2009 from the IRS with regards to this voluntary contribution. The IRS issues revenue rulings, which really almost have the same substance as a congressionally passed law. It's just sometimes it's murky, so Congress comes out and says, this is really what they meant. And this is the road that we're going to follow when we look at tax returns. And then they have revenue procedures that if you do things a certain way, they won't bother you. If you don't, you could potentially have issues with them. Then they have other things called notices. Now, this is what we need to drill in on here. There's an IRS notice, and they come out and they go, listen, this is the way we feel things should be. And in 2009, they had two notices. It's notice 2009-68 and 2009-75. And one of the notices said that your employer, if you take money out of something like the voluntary contribution, they use this term company plan. If you take it out of the company plan and you move it into a Roth, they could aggregate it with your thrift. Picture that. But they don't write it for the government. No IRS ruling, unless it's a private ruling, says this is for the government, this is for IBM, or this is for Sam and Sally Sub Shop. It's global. And the notice said that the employer would be responsible to explain to the employee or ex-employee of the taxation nature of it. And the other one was to say, now we're going to push it all together.
And
now,
you know, that's not going to happen.
Well, actually,
not in the government.
I am going to pat OPM on the back here.
Okay.
Being that this happened.
I'm talking about individual agencies. OPM does a yeoman job in trying to educate agencies about financial.
But this comes from OPM.
Yeah.
So the VC comes from OPM. And it's interesting because I had somebody in a week ago that didn't get one of these letters and one that was in a few weeks before that that did. The letters were the same. It says, hi, we moved your voluntary contribution to a Roth. And on the one, it said non-taxable portion. Beep. And the other one, it was silent. So they were subscribing to one of these IRS notices. But again, people doing this just need to be aware that if IRS then decides to move this up a notch and make it a ruling, then we have some issues. But we have an escape valve, and it's called recharacterization. It's kind of like a Seinfeld commercial. It's a do-over. So I moved my money over to the Roth, and I was very happy to do so. But then IRS said that I can't. I have until October 15th of the year following to move it back into an IRA and say, 1,000 pardons, please don't tax me. So for people that did it in 2010, they have until October 15th, 2011, just to kind of watch out what comes out. For the people doing it in 2011, they have until October 15th, 2012. So in other words, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but you shouldn't do it with the full feeling that it's not without question.
Now, I suppose we should mention that at the end of 2011, that was the last projected date I heard of, the Thrift Board is going to start offering a Roth TSP. Now, you can't, according to their rules, won't be able to take your money that's in your traditional thrift savings tax-deferred plan and move it to a Roth, which probably makes a lot of sense because that you could end up not doing the right thing. So they're trying to protect you that way. But you're free to open, you know, with your future contributions, choose a thrift savings plan Roth. And it seems to me, and we've had this discussion before, that particularly for younger people, this might be the better way to go. Because, yes, you're paying taxes while you're earning, but then, of course, the nature of a Roth is when you take the money out, it comes out tax-free.
I think it's just a slam dunk if they can afford to put a lot of money away.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're going to put money in the TSP anyway.
Oh yeah.
And you should, because you know at least 5% to get the full match, but more if you can do it, and up to the annual IRS max, it'd be great if you can do it. Then, yeah, maybe that Roth option is going to be very attractive. When it's launched.
Especially for somebody that is in a lower tax bracket in the initial stage of their career, and that money's going to grow for 30 years. And even though they might go into a higher bracket later.
Yeah, I think it's a great retirement tool.
Yeah.
And that's what, of course, the TSP is for your retirement. But if you can look forward to that money being withdrawn after retirement, tax with no further tax obligation, that to me is the way to go, it seems to me. That's what I would have done if I were young and still employed in the government.
Yeah. And we haven't gotten any calls, but we still have a few minutes left. 202-465-3080. Now, as we kind of come down to this, I won't say to the end of the discussion, but let's say somebody's doing the return and they go, oh my goodness, I didn't have enough withheld. And I've got a lot of bills and I've got a lot of expenses, but I don't have a lot of cash. What do I do? I tell you one thing that you don't do. Don't duck it. In other words, if you've got your return ready to go and it's April 18th, that's this year. Remember, we're listening to this show.
Yeah, why'd they go from Friday to Monday?
It's Emancipation Day in D.C., and it put it off. Well, we can't file on a Saturday. Can't file on a Sunday, so it ran to the Monday. Uh-huh. Now, Virginia said, we don't celebrate Emancipation Day, so whatever was due, although tax returns of Virginia are not due on April 15th anyway. It's May 1st.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, so all states necessarily aren't doing this. But whether they are or whether they aren't, and it's a good point, I don't have the money. I'll file an extension. Now, filing an extension is very easy, but you're supposed to pay money with the extension. So they're happy to let you file until October 15th. Just give them the money in advance. Now, if you don't do it, in concept, you're subject to really stiff penalties if you miss it by a large, I won't say a large margin, a medium margin. It's 5% a month, up to 25%, plus a late payment penalty, plus interest. I mean, it could get upwards of 7 or 8% a month. Ouch. Uh-huh. For the first 5 months. So you would do that. Now, let's say that you don't have the money to do it. File it anyway. Or file your tax return, and I think this would be the better way. In other words, things aren't really going to change between now and whenever you do get the money. And say, listen, I don't have the money, but I'll send you X dollars a month. And if that amount is under, $10,000, it's as simple as asking for it on a form. You don't even have to call up. You don't have to email. You just file the return and say, 1,000 pardons, but I don't have the money. Here's what I do have, and I'll pay you on the 15th of each month, the 30th of each month, whatever, and have it paid off within a couple years, and generally speaking, you're going to have no trouble. So some people just file the extension and hide, hoping that it'll get better. But the penalties, the feds sometimes are more lenient on the penalties than the states, but the states are not lenient. They're in pretty rough shape, and so they'll get your attention. So if you do have any cash, send it to the state first and then file the extension with both, but you get more time with the feds and a more lenient payment terms. So, people will call, what do I do? What do I do? Here's what you do. But don't do this. Don't bury your head in the sand and don't file an extension with no payment. So that's the way out of it. So that kind of took us from the beginning and looking for ways to hopefully shave the taxes. But if we don't, we don't. And then the final discussion, this was clipped this out of the Washington Post, I think it was a week or two ago, and they were talking about 11 ways to catch the IRS's attention. And, some of them, failure to report all your income. Duh. They call this the matching program. So if you get a form from somebody showing that you paid something or that you received income, well, you know who else got the same form. So they put it in the IRS's computer and they wait to find that it's on your return. And if it doesn't match, they'll send you a notice. And it's not an awful notice. They said, gee, you forgot to do this. This is the taxes on it and this is the interest on it. And if it's a large difference, they'll hit you with a penalty, but not an awful one. If you claim huge charitable donations, be sober with your valuations. I'm not going to tell you that's an audit me form, but relative to the size of one's income, if the income is X and the charitable donations are 50% of X, that's probably going to catch somebody's attention. For those that might have a small business, and they want to claim 100% of their car. I mean, people really get mad at me when I say you can't deduct 100% of your car. You just can't. Now, if it's a dump truck, fine, but I don't think our listening audience are driving dump trucks on the side. But they say, no, I have to leave my home or I leave my office and I go right to my business. Well, it's not deductible if you go from your home to your business. Got a caller. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a follow-up question on what you were talking about regarding the IRAs and the Roth, et cetera. on the new or upcoming TSP Roth, will you be able, aside from your money coming from, just a deduction to your payroll, will you be able, I know you indicated, of course, you can't bring it in from your other TSP accounts, but will you be able to roll money in kind of like a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA? Will you be able to roll any additional money for those of us who are later on in our career and would like a little diversity with a Roth?
The answer is, I believe you can, but I'm not so sure you want to. Because it's kind of in a steel box. Whereas if you were to take the same money that you talked about, you let's say that you had the opportunity to either move it into the TSP Roth or to a Roth IRA. The same rule would hold true. I would urge you to move it, and I'm not saying anything bad about the TSP. It's the IRS rules. I'd move it to a Roth, not a TSP Roth. Flexibility is greater.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And you can mirror the investment choices outside of the thrift, too. So if you really are enamored with the choices, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't be, they're good choices, you can do the same thing outside. The fees might be a little bit higher, but they're not going to be drastically higher. So you could have the best of both worlds. You could have what's inside of your TSP Roth, plus you can have other things that you can't have inside the TSP Roth. And mm-hmm. and the restrictions are a little greater inside of a 401k/TSP Roth than they are in a traditional Roth. I hope that made sense.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. All righty. Other things that could cause the IRS to look at your return, they're called hobby loss. Not necessarily somebody's hobby, but somebody says, I'm in business, I'm an antique picker, and I have to travel up and down the East Coast, the West Coast, or wherever, or you go on. What's that, what do they call it now, that they drive around to old farmhouses? What are they called?
Antiquing.
Pickers.
Oh, pickers.
So I'm in the picker business, and I drive my car, and yeah, they got a show on it. They're called the pickers.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and shows you what my life is like. Anyway, so these folks are self-employed, but some of the people I deal with, they say, yeah, I'm a picker. I'm an antiquer. And I go, yeah, and how much have you sold? Well, I'm warehousing everything in my home. Well, they're buying it for their house, and they're saying, well, eventually I'll sell it. And I go, you really shouldn't do this because, one, it's going to result in a loss, and, two, I'm not so sure you're in business. But let's say you really are in business, and you just started out and whatever the business is, and you lose money. Can you deduct it? Yeah. Lose money the next year. Can you deduct it? Yeah. But now you should be getting the picture. You're not really in business. So you got to watch out how many years you can claim a loss. And I'm getting the high sign that I have less than a minute to go. So, John, final questions, comments?
Well, I would say pay your taxes honestly, particularly if you work for the Department of the Treasury, because I think they can fire you if you don't, if you're with Treasury. Probably should extend that to the federal government, but I think most government employees are honest people. But
okay.
That's what I would.
Thanks, John. And next week, I actually know who's on, John and Mike Causey. So join us next week.
I didn't know that.
Have a good one. Bye bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Last April, 256 senior federal managers went missing. Are you next? The most successful managers know to never pass up an opportunity to learn. Join them this year to discover how to maximize your agency's forward momentum at the Federal Senior Management Conference at the Hyatt Regency Chesapeake Bay in Cambridge, Maryland, this April 10th through 13th. The Federal Senior Management Conference is the preeminent conference for senior federal managers, presented for government by government advisors, with registration open only to government employees. Register now at fedsmc.com or call 202-237-0300.
Connect with